Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where
prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.
Hey everyone, Scott here with a very short announcement. This episode is a sampler of a series that James Early and I are doing. It's part of our Key Battles in American History series, and this one focuses on World War II in the Pacific. James actually has his own podcast called Key Battles of American History, which you can find if you go to keybattlesofamericanhistory.com. We did a massive 30-part series, which is ongoing. He's about 12 to 13 episodes into it. We cover the battles of Pearl Harbor, the Coral Sea, Midway, and this snippet here is part one of a four-part episode on the Battle of Guadalcanal. So James does a fantastic job getting into the details of the battles, but also giving you big picture reference to understand what's going on. And I think this is our best series to date. So anyway, I hope you enjoy this episode and go check out the rest of the episodes. And there's many more to come. If you go to keybattlesofamericanhistory.com or just type in that phrase on the podcast player of your choice.
War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. War made the U.S. independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Understanding America's wars is essential for understanding American history. Welcome to Key Battles of American History, a podcast in which we discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. Here is your host, James Early.
Greetings. Welcome back to our series on the key battles of the Pacific War and World War II. This is James again, and I've got Scott with me as always. Scott, how are you, sir?
Doing all right. The Imperial Navy of Japan has taken a severe beating, and who knows, America's thinking, oh, wait, we can go on offense. Let's try this out a little bit.
Yes, it's time to use the football analogy. You can think of it as the U.S. is recovering a fumble, and they are going to start running the ball now. But Japan is not going to throw in the towel. They are not. They're down, but they're not out. So here we are at Key Battle 4, and I'm sorry, in our last episode, I failed to mention that the Battle of Midway was Key Battle 3. Hopefully you guys figured that out. So I can kind of recap. The first key battle was the attack on Pearl Harbor. Key Battle 2 was the Battle of the Coral Sea, which we did a couple episodes ago, or three. And Key Battle 3 was Midway. Now we're coming to an epic, long-lasting campaign. It's not really even a single battle. You know, like Midway was a few days, but this is going to last 6 months. This kind of reminds me of some of the World War I battles that Scott and I talked about in our World War I series. It's actually composed of several mini battles. And not even necessarily many, certainly not in terms of the amount of hardware that was used and the number of lives that were lost. So when I say the Battle of Guadalcanal, I should really say the Guadalcanal campaign, composed of many individual small battles. We are going to take our time on this one. We're going to dig pretty deep. This battle is very near and dear to me because, as I mentioned in our last episode, my father, Lieutenant Cleland Early, was a part of the Marine force that landed on Guadalcanal and fought with the Japanese. And he was in a very exciting and dangerous mission called the Long Patrol. And I believe it's not going to come up until our fourth episode on Guadalcanal. So it'll be a little while, but it'll be worth the wait, I think. So here we go. We're going to start Guadalcanal, and Scott is going to kick it off.
Yeah, so one thing I want to mention is to telescope out a bit and talk about what's happening among the U.S. military command. Because as we're talking about the series in the Pacific theater, it's easy to forget about the European theater. And there's so
wait,
different.
There's a European theater?
Wait, what? Oh, yeah.
No, just kidding, Lister.
I mean, it's kind of easy mentally when you get so sucked into one narrative, you forget everything else that's happening, that from the vantage point of the White House or being a Supreme Allied Commander or something like that, you're seeing the big picture. But for a particular story you're involved in, if you're watching Saving Private Ryan or Band of Brothers, you think that, well, things don't really heat up until D-Day. Or if you're looking at the Italian campaign, you're thinking 1943. Or if you're thinking of the North African campaign, like Operation Torch, you're also thinking of an earlier date. But for this is happening in 1942, the Pacific Theater. This is a full year or a full 2 years before other parts of the European theater are really heating up. But the United States is focusing extensively on Europe at this time. And this is going to mean that the Army Air Force commanders are struggling to obtain necessary resources. And the outcome of the Battle of Guadalcanal is going to have a huge impact on this. So I just want to mention a few things here. That there was a struggle of U.S. military command of a Germany-first approach to the war versus a focus on the Pacific. So this policy of Germany-first, those who supported that time included Henry Hap Arnold, the commanding general of the Army Air Force. And this policy made the Pacific a secondary theater in the conference rooms of Anglo-American military planners. But keep in mind, this is still only a few months after Pearl Harbor, and on the streets of the United States, the opposite feeling is there, that it was Japan that attacked Pearl Harbor, and the common sentiment was that war against Japan could come first. And just about everyone that Hap Arnold spoke with in the Army, the Navy, the U.S. Army Air Force didn't like the Germany first paradigm, and they knew that a lot of resources were being put forth on Operation Torch to enter North Africa. But they thought that so much focus on this was a detriment to stop the Japanese. And they also didn't like the current planning among the U.S. Army Air Force to use long-range bombers in a strategic air offensive against Germany. And Chester Nimitz even told Arnold that the bombardment of Germany was of no use. So now, in a sense, I mean, they were Army planners were using the best information available. But at the time, in 1942, Australia was in much greater danger of a Japanese invasion than Britain was of Nazi Germany. And Operation Torch, to many people in the Pacific, it seemed much more of a local matter than fighting in the South Pacific. So there's this behind-the-scenes struggle going on, but what happens in Guadalcanal is really going to shift Army command and how they allocate resources. So just want to mention that point there. And why Australia is vulnerable, James, I think you'll mention when you give the background to this battle.
Right. Now, regarding that Germany first strategy, one person that was definitely not on board with the Germany first strategy was U.S. Supreme Naval Commander Admiral Ernest King. Admiral King very much had a Pacific mindset, as did much of the Navy, of course. King wanted to go on the offensive in the Pacific. And he saw the Solomon Islands as the best place to start. They were just east of the major Japanese air and naval base of Rabaul, which is on New Britain. And I'm sorry if I mispronounced that. I'll work on it. But anyway, the Japanese had already occupied Tulagi, which was one of the islands in the Solomon's chain, and those needed to be removed. So the Solomon Islands, let's try to do a mental map for the Solomon Islands. Think kind of as a like a ladder, but the parts you step on, the rungs of the ladder is taken off, and you have just like little, like almost like two dashed lines going from northwest to southeast, so diagonally, one on top and one on bottom. I don't know if that makes any sense. Almost like a ladder, but with no rungs, and it's dashed lines. And each dash is one island. That's roughly kind of how the Solomon Islands work. They run, as I implied before, from the northwest to the southeast. Guadalcanal is one of the larger islands in the chain. So on July 2nd, Ernest King ordered the attack, and it was begin on August 1st. This is less than 2 months after Midway. The attack on the Solomons would be called Operation Pestilence. I like that title, Pestilence. And it would have three phases. Phase one would be seizing Tulagi and the adjacent positions. That in and of itself was called Operation Watchtower, but the Marines called it Operation Shoestring because they felt like they were getting ripped off and they were not getting the financial and equipment support that they needed. Phase two was to seize the rest of the Solomons and a few positions on New Guinea. Phase three would be to attack and recapture Rabaul. So I'm just going to call it Rabaul. I think it's one of those words that you read in books and you don't hear pronounced out loud a lot. So again, if I'm wrong, folks, I apologize, but I'm going to go with Rabaul. All right. As I mentioned, Guadalcanal was one of the larger Solomon Islands. It was populated primarily by several thousand Melanesians, and it was covered in dense jungles. It also had some high ground on it. It was a British possession, although the British government had evacuated nearly all British and other European personnel there due to fears of a Japanese invasion, which of course did happen. The Japanese are going to take it from the British. And in late June of 1942, Martin Clemens, a British official who was still on the island, reported that Japanese forces who had landed on the island of Guadalcanal seemed to be beginning construction of something. And that something appeared to be an airfield. On July 6th, he radioed again that an airfield was definitely being built. This is a big problem for the Allies because this position is relatively far to the east. You're getting kind of dangerously close to American possessions. You definitely do not want a Japanese airfield there. And by the way, I should mention that Martin Clemens, he was extremely helpful and important to the Allies, but he wasn't the only Allied observer. There were also Allied observers on other islands that would also provide critical intelligence about Japanese military operations. And these people risked their lives. They lived a very dangerous existence. The Japanese were constantly hunting for them. They were having to move around. Fortunately, the natives on the islands were helping them because they didn't like the Japanese either. But the intelligence that they would provide to the Allies, and especially the Americans, would be invaluable. All right, so again, if a Japanese airstrip were completed, it would greatly extend the reach of Japanese combat aircraft into the Southwest Pacific. Would also threaten the Allied supply line between Hawaii and Australia. We've already talked about that once, how important that supply line was from Hawaii to Australia. And the Japanese had already tried to disrupt that once in the operations that led up to the Battle of the Coral Sea. And we saw that was foiled by the Americans and the other Allies. Now it's being threatened again. We can't lose that supply line, the Americans said. And so to prevent the completion of the Japanese airstrip, the American High Command decided to send a Marine force to invade Guadalcanal. Yay, Marines. I love the Marines. I'm going to cheer every time we talk about them because my dad is a Marine. So the Marines, and eventually Army as well, will invade Guadalcanal, eject the Japanese, and build an Allied airstrip. That's the plan. So instead of having a Japanese airstrip, we're going to have an American airstrip. You think they could pull it off, Scott? What do you think of the plan?
Now, I'm all for them, and the planning is great, but one tricky thing with this is your mental maps are always great, James, but I wonder how well the military leaders could plan for this, because we're talking about the utter boonies of the Pacific, islands that are thousands of miles away from American shores. I would imagine very little commercial traffic ever moves through here. This is the early 1940s. So, how good were their maps? Did they actually know beyond just the general shape of the islands about, depth of water and other factors of naval intelligence that would affect how you set up a plan? I mean, they really know what's going on here?
Unfortunately for the Americans, they did not have good knowledge of the island. Maps were few. They were unreliable. Some of the maps they were using were from the 1800s. I've even read in one place some of the maps they had were from the 1700s.
Captain Cook himself wrote it.
Arr, that's right. Yes. So anyway, And only limited air reconnaissance was possible. You know, you had Japanese planes within short range. They were flying all over the place. So the Americans are going in not totally blind, but certainly not as knowledgeable as they wish they had. I should also make a little mental map of the island of Guadalcanal itself. And it's shaped, if you want to be real generic, you could almost say it's shaped kind of like a football. It's very wide if you're going from east to west, north to south, not as wide. I kind of think it looks like, you know, those socks that people wear. I even have some. They're really short. They're not ankle socks. They're the kind that you can barely see when you've got your running shoe on. You know what I'm talking about, Scott?
I do, yes.
Yeah, okay. So everybody's seeing you, and you've got a little part that kind of sticks up in the back above your heel. It looks like a sock to me. It looks like one of those running socks. The heel is on the left side and the toe is on the right side. So, but the invasion is going to occur at the top part, kind of like the arch of the foot, if you will, the top of the foot. It's going to land slightly to the east. And really, the fighting is actually only going to occur on a relatively small portion of the island. It's a big island. Not gigantic or anything like New Guinea or Borneo or anything like that, but significantly bigger than some of the other islands in the Solomons. Okay, planning was disorderly, mainly due to lack of time. They wanted to hurry. Let's strike while the iron is hot, while the Japanese are back on their heels. That's twice I've mentioned heels, Scott, in like 2 minutes. I don't know what that's.
So means. Someone is going to get a severe case of athlete's foot on the Solomon Island, or toenail fungus, or other foot analogies we can.
They definitely are. There are going to be a lot of sore heels. So, okay, getting serious again. Sorry, folks. The overall commander of the operation was Navy Admiral Robert Lee Gormley. And the naval forces under him were divided into a carrier force commanded by Richard Jack Fletcher. He was, of course, the main naval commander at Midway, and a transport escort fleet commanded by Richmond Kelly Turner. All right. What about Fletcher? What do you have some thoughts on Fletcher?
Well, it's interesting that even now we're only a few months into the war, but there are already people rising to the top with their experience in previous battles. You mentioned that Fletcher commanded carriers at Midway. He also did it at Coral Sea. And he could very well be at this time one of, if not the world's leading experts of carrier or flat top warfare. And this helps him when his planes are able to overcome some of the defenders. So you're already seeing some people rise to the top with their experience.
Yeah, exactly. Frank Jack Fletcher. I think I said the wrong name. I think I said Richard. I'm sorry. It's Frank Jack Fletcher. Okay, so. Enter the Marines. Dun, 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 dun. You're standing at attention, right, listener? Oh, so. Anyway, if not, at ease. Or if you are at ease, if not, shame on you. The 1st Marine Division, under the command of Major General Alexander Vandegrift, was ordered to land on the shore and move to take the airstrip, the one that the Japanese were building, as quickly as possible. But most of the Marines, even though they're tough, they are Marines, but they're far from being combat ready. Many of them are green. Few had any combat experience. The 1st Division would be supported by paratroopers, as well as the 1st Raider Battalion, commanded by Colonel Merritt Edson. The Raiders, I will have a lot to say about the Raiders, but the Raiders were an elite unit within the elite. Now, everybody knows the Marines are arguably probably the most elite of the branches. They're the toughest guys. You know, remember the old recruiting thing, maybe you could be one of us, although the implication was probably not, but maybe. The Marines prided themselves in their toughness, but within the Marines, you had this unit called the Raiders. And this, I think eventually I'm going to do a mini episode on this or something, because my dad was in the 2nd Raider Battalion. So these are the toughest of the tough, but this is the 1st Raider Battalion. My dad is not in this group. They are, altogether, there's about 19,000 men. The Raiders had been to Tulagi. By the end of July, or they're going to go to Tulagi. They haven't gotten there yet. By the end of July, the Marines were in Fiji, awaiting a final rehearsal for the assault. But the rehearsal did not go well. Again, just inexperience, hurry up and mess it up, that kind of thing. So it's not looking really promising at first. And because things are not going well, the attack, which had been scheduled for August 1st, was postponed to August 7th. Vandergrift wanted it postponed even more, but he was told, you got six more days. So the plan was for an armada of transport ships to take the Marines to the northern shore of Guadalcanal, where they would transfer to landing craft, LCI Large, and assault the beach. And we'll encounter many of these LC ships and boats over the course of our series, and we'll talk about them as we get to them. This group, the LCI Large boats, were 160 feet long, and they could carry 210 troops or 75 tons of cargo, so pretty significant. Other forces would occupy the surrounding islands of Tulagi, Gavutu, and Tanambogo. Now, the size of the Japanese force that was defending Guadalcanal was unknown to the Americans. It was estimated to be about 7,000. And the landing would be supported by Fletcher's fleet of 16 destroyers, six cruisers, a battleship, and the aircraft carrier Saratoga, Wasp, and Enterprise to provide air support. Wasp, I should say, was a smaller carrier than the other two. The American carriers contained Dauntless dive bombers, Wildcat fighters, and Devastator torpedo bombers. Again, these are all outclassed by their Japanese equivalents. Also, the American invasion fleet would be opposed by a Japanese fleet that lay to the north. This included the Shokaku, Zuikaku. Those two, of course, are veterans of both Pearl Harbor and Midway. I'm sorry, they were not at Midway. They were at Coral Sea. And then you had another carrier called the Ryujo. The Japanese carriers had Zero fighters and G4M Betty bombers. So a lot of Japanese hardware waiting for the Americans. The Japanese theater commander was Vice Admiral Gunichi Mikawa. Japanese ground forces in the region consisted of the 17th Army with 50,000 men, commanded by Lieutenant General Harukichi Hayutake. And under him was Major General Kawaguchi, who commanded the Japanese forces actually on Guadalcanal. And there was one other leader of note that I want to mention. We'll meet him pretty soon. Colonel, Kiyonao Ichiki. He was a key battalion commander. So there you go. We've laid out what kind of ships each side has and what kind of men are going to be fighting. I'm excited. This is our first land battle. This is the first time that American forces are going to be fighting Japanese forces on land. So far, we've been doing a bunch of naval battles, and that's great, but we're going to do both in this battle. Right, Scott?
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.